Welcome to the Undisclosed Addendum. Today we're talking about episode 7 in our current series, The State versus Greg Lance. That episode is called Hurry Up and Wait, and if you haven't heard it yet, go back and listen. We will be right here waiting for you when you're done. I'm Rebecca Lavoy, host of the True Crime Review podcast, Crime Writers On, and one of the audio editors for Undisclosed. And with me today is Rabia Chaudhry. She's the host of this series and the New York Times best-selling author of Adnan's story. Hey, Rabia.
Hey, Rebecca.
Also with us is Susan Simpson. She's an attorney and the blogger behind The View from LL2 and tweeter of all kinds of interesting facts. Hello, Susan.
Hey, Rebecca.
Well, before we start, I'm going to give a quick synopsis of this week's episode. In the episode, we hear about the 18-month period between the time of Greg's arrest and his trial. Right before his arrest, though, investigators place Robert Shepard, the man who they can last place the murder weapon with, under hypnosis, hoping he can remember to whom he gave the gun. In the meantime, they're looking for Greg, who moved to Florida with his wife Becky a few months earlier. And to find her, they interrogate her mother and find out she, Becky, has a doctor's appointment for her pregnancy. Investigators set up surveillance at the doctor's, but Becky and Greg never show up. After he's arrested, Greg hires John Nisbet and begins demanding a speedy trial, raising numerous motions for one. All were denied. Greg's bond is set at $1 million, and he's frustrated with his legal representation, further frustrated with the defense investigator that is appointed to his case, and when a public defender is appointed, is unhappy with him too. They clash on defense and trial strategy, and his lawyers ask the court to order a psych evaluation, concerned about Greg's fitness to make strategic legal decisions. Greg is found competent, though, and eventually gets his way on two issues that end up having a profound impact on his defense, whether to present his affair partner Debbie as an alibi and whether to take a second-degree murder plea. Now, one of the things that was interesting to me at the start of this episode, Rabia, is you set it up straight at the beginning. You say that Greg is really, really smart. In fact, you say he's one of the smartest people you've met. Can you talk about that a little bit more? That really stuck out to me.
Yeah, he's just really, I mean, first, I've always been struck by the fact that he can remember so many names, and not names of just like the seminal people in his case, but names of like a witness who had a brother, who had a cousin who might have visited the Heron Farm once. I mean, like, he is just, he just has an incredible memory. But he's also, he's just really bright. He can talk about a lot of things, you know. He's also, you know, I found this letter, which doesn't have to do exactly what we're talking about, but it just kind of gives an example to me of the kind of person he is. And I think the letter is about 10 or 12 years old, or maybe even older than that, actually. And he had a new cellmate, and the cellmate was a transgender individual, a black transgender individual. And Greg writes this letter. Of course, all these letters that, you know, we hauled from his mother's house, they have no expectation that anybody else is going to ever be reading them, especially not lawyers who have a podcast and will be talking about it 10, 15 years later. But he wrote a letter to his mom about this, his new cellmate. And this is way before the kind of awareness around pronouns, the, you know, more awareness around the danger to transgender lives and transgender rights. This is way before that. And he was just so just respectful. And he, in the entire letter, he referred to his cellmate with the proper pronoun as she. And it was just, you know, he talked about how, like, what a lovely person that, you know, his cellmate was, what she was. And I was just kind of struck at, like, you know, I maybe it's my own prejudice that I'm imagining a man raised in the 70s and 80s in the South, a white man raised, you know what I mean, like a Southern white man raised in the South, would have that kind of, like, respect and sensitivity and just, you know, decency in this situation. And so I just repeatedly have found these kinds of things in his letters, and in talking to him, he's just really bright. He's just smart. Having said that, though, I think it's interesting also, I have read like Ron Lax, who was this investigator, I think there was one memo that he wrote where he said that Greg thinks he's smarter than he is or something like that. Like sometimes I think it rubs people the wrong way. But yeah, he's, to me, I mean, I'm really impressed with him.
Susan, it really surprised me that law enforcement used hypnosis with this guy who was trying to remember where the gun ended up, Shepard. What did you think about that?
I wasn't surprised because at least it's better than when they use psychics. They do that too. They'll usually like often leave it off books as well because they don't want to reveal they're doing it, but they still do it.
They still do today? Like, that's still happening?
I don't know about today, but, like, within the past 10 years, yeah. Definitely had a few case files where that was involved. Mm-hmm. On the one hand, I guess I kind of, I don't want to say harmless, but I see less danger in it in this particular situation. It doesn't seem like it's been, like, a false positive necessarily because they'd still need to find the gun or an actual connection. So I think in terms of, like, danger to individuals out there, I think it's relatively low risk, but in terms of like return, also probably a low hit there.
I mean, you know, I thought about this and here's what I'm trying to imagine. The danger with hypnosis is, and we've seen this in a lot of different cases, is like, you know, especially, you know, those famous or infamous cases of the, you know, people who alleged child abuse as children and then they used hypnosis and false memories were planted doing that. Let's say Robert Shepard was put under and he said, oh yeah, this guy who matches the description of Greg, because the investigators have planted this or they've shown him pictures of Greg or something like that. I mean, or anybody, like pick a suspect that they want to nail, right? And if it's a state in which that then becomes admissible, that this guy now remembers, like, this is the person I sold it to, I think that's the danger there. I think unless whatever evidence they can elicit from, or whatever they can, I don't even know if it's evidence, whatever they can elicit through a session like this, they can independently then verify. I think it is dangerous.
Well, I think that's the point. That's the point of what they're trying to do, is that if they get a lead, they can find the gun. I don't think they're trying to necessarily use the under hypnosis testimony.
Oh, I totally think in this case, I think if he had said, this is what the guy looked like, and the description matched Greg, they absolutely would have had him testify to that.
He had to explain, like, why and how he sold it. Like, why I had no records. I mean, yes, there is a danger. I'm not in favor of it, but, like...
Yeah.
Rebecca, you'll know this. What is the podcast I'm thinking of where they had these two boys go under hypnosis that totally didn't work?
Oh, I don't know.
What?
Is that a true crime podcast? You're not podcast theory?
No. It sounds like if Colin were here, he would totally know. What were they under hypnosis for? Do you remember?
They saw something on the night of a girl went missing, but it didn't work there either. I've never heard of it actually working. I'm sure maybe there's one case. Like hypnosis in theory, it could theoretically like maybe possibly work. But
it has worked. It's worked. Actually, you know, it has worked in a few very high profile cases, including like that one back from like the 70s or 80s where like an entire bus of children was hijacked along with the bus driver and the whole bus was buried underground or in a quarry. Well, it's a crazy case. And so the bus driver, when they actually escaped, the bus driver, they used hypnosis for him to remember the tags of the car of the perps. And that's how they found him. Yeah. So it has worked in a few different cases, but it's also been involved in at least 10 wrongful convictions. So it's like...
For those who are curious, what Robbie is referring to is a crazy case. I remember hearing about it on a different podcast and then going into a rabbit hole. It's the 1976 Chowchilla kidnapping. It happened in California in 1976, obviously. Three kidnappers imprisoned their victims in a buried box truck, but they were kidnapped on a school bus. After 16 hours underground, the driver and children were able to dig themselves out and escape. That was what happened in that case. It's crazy.
It's a crazy case.
It's a crazy case. It's like the kind of thing that would be like a bad Law and Order plot, but it was real.
And they were all captured. Yeah.
Yeah.
According to the U.S. Census, approximately 2 million burglaries are reported each year in the United States.
Wow. That's kind of scary.
Well, what's crazy is that only 1 in 5 homes have home security. Maybe that's because most companies don't make it easy to have home security.
This is true. I have had experience. It's a hassle. And also pretty expensive, by the way.
It is. And if like you're a renter or you move, you know, every 3 years or live in the city, it can be hard to like even be able to have security system.
Yeah, that's why SimpliSafe is our top choice. First of all, SimpliSafe protects every door, window, and room with 24/7 professional monitoring.
They make it easy. There's no contract, hidden fees, or fine print.
They've got a ton of awards from CNET to the New York Times Wirecutter. Their prices are fair and honest. It's affordable for once.
Seriously, the Wirecutter is like my go-to for everything. If they recommend it, it's good to go.
You can get their around-the-clock monitoring for just $15 a month, which is just kind of amazing.
But one thing that truly makes SimpliSafe stand out is their video verification technology. When other home security systems are triggered, a lot of the time police assume it's a false alarm and the call goes to the bottom of the list, but not with SimpliSafe. Using their video verification technology, they are able to visually confirm that the break-in is happening, allowing police to get to the scene 3.5 times faster than with other home security companies.
So for our listeners, SimpliSafe has a huge deal going on right now. Go to simplisafeundisclosed.com and get free shipping and a money-back guarantee. That's SimpliSafe, S-I-M-P-L-I-S-A-F-E, undisclosed.com today. SimpliSafeundisclosed.com.
So, Rabia, you point out that Greg, after his arrest and then since then, has been suffering from depression. Is this something that he told you he grappled with before all of this went down, or is this after all of this went down?
I mean, the way it sounds is as if he did, he didn't know about it. He might have. I mean, like, when I think about some of the letters that I've read when he's written about, like, to his mother about what life was like before and after, and also the circumstances in which he was raised were not optimal. He was he calls himself a free range kid, raised very, I mean, his parents got divorced when he was very, very young, I think two maybe, and his mother moved away to another, moved to Florida with her new husband. And he was raised with his brothers by his father, who was also very not available. And so he ended up bouncing around to different, I think, different relatives as well. So maybe he did. I don't know. I think, but this was the, after he was arrested, apparently what happened was he just started having trouble getting up. He would just sleep for like 12, 14 hours. He just couldn't get up. And he, I mean, the prison mostly didn't care, except that it meant he was late for work. And then when they kind of dug in a little further, they recognized they had depression. So, you know, if he had it before, it wasn't diagnosed.
One thing I want to come back to in a minute is the series of evaluations that Greg had. He had two, but initially he had a first evaluation, a general competency evaluation, a stand trial. Is that routine in Tennessee?
I'm actually not sure.
Yeah.
I don't know. Susan, is that something you know? I mean, is that something that's done like...
I wouldn't say standard, but it's often something they'll get granted because it's sort of a low risk, like... Return. The problem is, like, you don't allow it to happen. The judge says no. It's an easy issue to appeal. So even if you think it's probably not going to be important, or you're inclined to not allow it because you think it's a waste, it's easier just to go ahead and grant it. On appeal, they're not like, well, look what the judge did, and easily they would have found this problem, and therefore the whole trial is bunk.
Right. One of the things that was most interesting to me about this episode, it was kind of like the heart of the episode for me, was the way Greg dealt with his defense and his attorneys. He didn't really let his attorneys handle the defense themselves. He wanted to manage different aspects of it. It seems like a good thing, generally speaking, especially when you know in retrospect that it didn't turn out well for the client. And the question very often is, like, why didn't anyone say anything? This attorney wasn't doing this or that or this. But he did this with everything. And I'm curious, like, how it plays with lawyers. Do attorneys welcome feedback from clients? Like, there's a line there, right? Where an attorney wants to say to a client, like, dude, you're not a lawyer. We know what we're doing. And Greg seems to have been very comfortable crossing those lines. But I'm not sure what you guys think in terms of where he landed on that spectrum.
I mean, look, you know, along with whatever was in the episode, there are just so many letters that Greg has written to his lawyers in which he's made lists in these letters and memos. He's written lists of maybe like 50 investigative tasks that he wants them to do, or, you know, a list of this many people he wants them to talk to. I mean, it's, and so, and you're talking about, obviously lawyers have limited time. The investigator, Ronald Lax, as far as I could tell, he didn't, I thought he did a pretty good job, to be honest. His file is pretty thorough, and how, you know, the people he spoke to and all the leads he followed up on. And having said that, there were certainly things that were overlooked that if, like, there were maybe a few people that, you know, Greg was right about, they should have spoken to back then and they didn't, but they only would have caught those people if they had spoken to all 150 that Greg had demanded. I mean, it's hard. I mean, like, you know, I think about like other cases in which clients don't advocate for themselves at all. Here, Greg really did. And I think I don't know exactly what the line is, but I think a client should know what's happening. They should have some say in what's happening, but in aspects of like legal strategy, there should be some level of deference to attorneys, but I don't know. Susan, what do you think?
I had a case once where I was struggling with something similar, and an older, wiser attorney told me something that I try and remember now, which is that sometimes you can't save a client from themselves. Mm. There are sometimes that there's nothing you can do to make things better because the client is incapable of helping themselves. And as an attorney, your job is to try and make them help themselves and to try and do what you can to get things in a working position, but it's not always possible. Mm. For Greg and for others in the position, it's definitely a catch-22. If you don't advocate for yourself, you maybe get lost in the system forever, and there's no guarantee anyone's ever coming looking for you. But if you do advocate for yourself, there's a risk that you're going to interfere with people who are genuinely trying to help you and are better equipped to do it.
That's interesting. I mean, other thing that makes me think about is, you know, my only like intersection with, you know, working with attorney to represent me is like in family matters, right? But even in that situation, sometimes, you know, you're either paying attorney in a lot of money, but in this case, even if you're a public defender, like there is a sense like this person's working for me. And I don't think there's a lot of perspective on exactly how much else like an attorney or a public defender or somebody else is doing that, like they have multiple clients, you know, in the case of public defenders, dozens or in some states, hundreds of clients. And they can be present for the things they can be present for and not present for things they're not present for. And I can imagine that for someone in Greg's position, who's basically like, I did not do this, and I don't understand why that isn't 100% of your focus is helping me prove I didn't do it, I would understand that would be frustrating. But I also understand the lawyer who at some point might just be like, I cannot work with this person. I can't do my job with this constant interference. Yeah. You know?
And it always it breaks down the relationship between attorney and client. Like, you want your client involved. You want your client to, because the client, in most cases, whatever it's civil or criminal or whatever, they know the facts a lot of the time, or they know stuff that matters, and they may not know why it matters or not know why it's important. So they need to be able to give you those facts so you can figure out how to use it. So you need a really good, honest back and forth and a vibrant discussion there. Like, hey, look at this. Oh, I didn't think about that. Yeah, that's all fine. It's when the client starts doing things that are contrary to his own legal interests that everything starts to kind of get this bad, you know, snowball effect.
Yeah. I mean, look, I've had clients come, I mean, and this is completely in an immigration context where they have their own legal strategy about how they want to adjust their status. Let's say they're completely undocumented or they're in some kind of limbo. And I know that number one, this is going to like either get them deported or it's not legal or whatever. And I just refuse to take the client. I mean, I just won't do it. Having said that, when you actually have an existing client, I mean, like the obligations are different. In immigration matters, as long as you're not in front of a court, you can withdraw as counsel with like regular adjudication. But I mean, here it's like, you know, there were things like, for example, Greg's lawyers didn't hire a single expert. There's not a single defense expert in this case. And he was right there, right? Like they could have done a better job. And there are many a times when you're reading the trial, you're like, oh my God, they missed like these incredible opportunities, but that's also, they're human beings. I mean, it happens, especially in the course of this, like, you know, an active trial, you miss an opportunity to say something or point something out. I remember when I read the closing arguments in this, I was just like, God, you know, I mean, like it wasn't bad as Gutierrez, for example, but it was pretty unstructured, and they were not as prepared as Greg would have liked them to be, but they could never probably be as prepared as Greg. So there's that. It's hard. But, you know, on the two big issues that we talked about in the episode, I think he might have been right on one and he was not right on the other one. That's how I feel about it.
Hmm. One final question about this, but like his lawyer wanted to get rid of him and he wanted to get rid of his lawyer. There's like this mutual seeming dislike for that initial attorney-client relationship, right?
Well, it's also about getting a better, a more guaranteed payment stream for the attorney.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Getting him paid. Right. It was interesting. So one of the things I have sort of tying to that is this second evaluation requested by Greg's attorneys because he feels like he's not able to work with them competently. That seemed like a red flag to me. Like, his attorneys, were they trying to just get him to stop doing what he was doing by giving him this evaluation? What were they trying to prove to the court? Something about that felt really strange to me.
You know, to me, what it seemed like, given what the one attorney Judd told the psych evaluator, was almost like he was trying to get them to say, this guy is not competent enough to make his own legal, like, you know, to make his own decisions on legal strategy. So then they could have either Greg's family do it or somebody, you know what I mean? Or make it themselves, like, and basically not follow they wanted a way out of being, they didn't want to do what Greg wanted. And so they wanted a way out. That's what it seemed like to me. Cause it was, Judd was pretty specific about what he was looking for.
Hmm. What were your thoughts about that, Susan?
Basically the same. They wanted, I mean, obviously there had been a breakdown in the client-attorney relationship. The attorneys thought that their client was making a very dumb decision. Most of the time you're just like, well, you can't stop that. Like, that's their call. But sometimes it's kind of that is another option. If you really think the client's making the totally wrong decision and you just can't get through to them, you could say, well, Your Honor, I don't think my client's capable of making the right decision. So let's make sure that they can actually decide what they're trying to decide here. And in this case, right, the testing was like, yep, they can decide that. So that's his call to make.
Yeah. I mean, does this come down to, we're going to talk about these two big issues in a minute, but the red flag for me, it sounded like, and maybe it was just the order in which I sort of absorbed the information in the episode, was they wanted him to plea it out and he wouldn't agree. And it just felt kind of draconian to me that it was like, you're not agreeing to do this thing. And so we're going to evaluate you with this like evaluation. Was a desired outcome there that they'd be able to pressure him to taking the plea in some way, or that it would take the decision out of his hands in some way?
As far as I know, I can't determine the dates of when, because the plea negotiations began verbally and then there was a written offer close to trial. But and the trial happened in October of 2000, but and this evaluation, I think the second one happened either in late August or September. But the affidavit that his lawyer filed to get the court to order this was actually back in May. And to me, that was around the time they were arguing over the Debbie issue. So I don't know if it was that triggered it, or it was just a year's worth of, you know, being exhausted by Greg that did it. But
or
it could
be a better position for a plea bargain.
Yeah. And I don't know. Like, again, it could be that they had already been having plea negotiations at that point. I'm not sure about that. So, but yeah, from May to September, you know, that's how long that thing lasted.
Now, Robbie, the two main issues that do come up between him and his legal team are the plea deal and the Debbie witness thing. Let's talk about the plea deal first, but I think it's a little bit easier to tackle. You said a few minutes ago that you think he was right to fight on one and maybe not necessarily right to fight on the other. I'm assuming you meant the plea deal when you said he was right to fight on that. Was that right, or am I wrong? Am I getting that wrong?
Yeah. I mean, given like what they offered and to this day, you know, Greg and his family, and I get it. I mean, like, and I've heard this not just from him as a defendant, but other defendants as well. It's kind of like, you know, lawyers are like, damned if you do, damned if you don't. If they really advocate for a client to take the plea, then sometimes the client will feel like, oh, you just want to wash your hands of this and I'm the one who's going to spend the time in prison. But if they don't do it and then the client gets convicted, then the client will be upset that my lawyer didn't fight for this harder and convince me of it. So it's a hard position to be in. I think, given the terms of the plea, you know, which he probably would have served just a few more years, it probably was the right thing to do. At that point, they didn't know every single thing, but they did know enough in the case that he knew that there were a number of people in his orbit who were going to testify against him. And also he knew, because he was not going to present Debbie. He should have known that he would have no way then in court to account for at least that part of the evening of the night, you know, the murders. So, and he did want to testify. That was another point of contention. He wanted to testify. That was a fight between him and the lawyers. And they're like, nope, you're not going to do that.
Do you think it would have helped him or hurt him? I know that generally the rule of thumb is that you shouldn't.
Almost always.
It always hurts.
Except the very narrow, narrow circle. Like, there's times where you have to roll the dice on it, but most of the time it's always going to hurt. In this case, it could only hurt. What did Greg know that you couldn't get in through other evidence? Nothing.
Yeah.
But couldn't he get up there and say he doesn't know?
That never works. Never.
It never works.
Unless the client has something actually affirmatively to add to the evidence. I mean, it's you don't want to invite the jury to look into their character or their soul, make a judgment based on that.
Right. I have been following Colin Miller's Twitter feed long enough to know that in some places there's a rule where if you take a plea, you cannot appeal later. Is this one of these places?
Depends on what the plea says and how they structure it. But usually not.
And I do know, I mean, this is like it's a painting with broad strokes, but you know, one of the things that we talk about a lot is whether or not somebody who refuses to take a plea fights, says, I'm not going to do it because I didn't commit the crime. Yes, it's an easy case to make that like a guilty person would say that too. But isn't that exactly what we would all do? I mean, that I would probably do that if we've argued about this sometimes in my own podcast. Like if somebody offers you 5 years or 10 years for something that if you go to trial, you get 30 years for, but you know, you didn't do it. What do you do? And I always am on the side of like, I would find it almost impossible to make a deal and admit something that I know I didn't do. And of course, you've got Toby on the other end who's like, take the plea, man.
I mean, for me, the only answer to that question is you look at the evidence, evaluate what you're being offered and what you think your chances are, and make a decision based on that. But I always tend to err on the side of if you can come home, come home.
Right. Yeah.
You know, I asked Greg, I said, you know, you were incarcerated for like, I mean, he was awaiting trial for 18 months. You know, he's with a lot of other people who have been in and out of prison for years. I said, didn't others advise you about taking a plea or not? He said, yeah, they did. They all told me to take the plea. He's like, but the thing is, he's like, I get it because they did what they were convicted of, or they took plea deals. And in many cases, they pled on lesser charges than the crimes they actually committed. He's like, so I couldn't take their advice. He's like, how am I going to take their advice? They're actual criminals.
But how does he know that? Plenty of them could have been innocent because people take pleas and aren't guilty all the time.
Probably, but I think there are also people in there who are like, dude, man, I got away with XYZ when I took this plea and I got lucky, so you should take the plea too.
They were overcharged in the first place, so they bargained down something closer to what they should.
Yeah, but you know, this is like his first stint in prison and that's his perception.
Yeah.
So Susan, are you a hot sleeper or a cold sleeper? Do you sweat like in your sleep?
Am a finicky, difficult sleeper.
Oh, are you really?
Yeah. I get hot, I get cold, the whole spectrum.
Okay, well that can be complicated, but here's the thing. Bowl and Branch can actually respond to all those needs. I've been using Bowl and Branch sheets for about 2.5 years now, and I've had a number of sets, and I have the cotton ones. Well, they're all made of super soft cotton, but I have like the regular cotton ones for the summer. And now as it's getting colder, I have pulled out the flannel sheets and they are amazing.
The flannels are amazing. I mean, they're all super soft, but the breathable and also warm combo is key and also very difficult to achieve.
Yeah. And I also share a bed with, well, my husband, but also nowadays our little man, 2.5, going on linebacker, and they are both quite sweaty. So having breathable sheets means I don't have to wash my sheets every other day.
Bowl and Branch sheets are soft, they're comfortable, they're stylish, and for a limited time, you can get their luxury flannel bedding to keep you cool sleepers warm, and because they breathe, keep the warm sleepers cool.
And by the way, shipping is always free, and you can try them out for 30 nights risk-free. Right now, you get $50 off your first set of sheets at bowlandbranch.com with the promo code undisclosed. Get $50 off at bowlandbranch.com, promo code undisclosed. And by the way, as the holidays roll around, they make great gifts. They are packaged beautifully. So check it out, bollandbranch.com, and use the promo code undisclosed for $50 off.
Well, let's talk about that big second issue, because I know I've got questions. The second issue is Debbie, or the woman that we are calling Debbie, which, by the way, good journalistic decision here. There's no public good in calling
I see no reason for it.
There is no reason for it. Okay, so the woman we're calling Debbie, not Debbie, perhaps we should call her. There was an opportunity to present her at trial. She had an alternate version of the story about her night with Greg. She says they were together until the early morning hours, 4 a.m., which on its face is helpful, because it provides him with a direct alibi to the murders. But Greg says, no, that's not what happened. I left earlier, and basically says, like, yeah, I would have had time to commit the murders because I actually left much earlier. His lawyers want to put Debbie on the stand. Greg says no. This is a very tricky dilemma, and I'd love to hear both of your thoughts about it. Susan, I'm going to start with you, you know, as the person who's like, and you're doing the podcast, but Robbie, I think, is a little closer to Greg and the story here. What do you think about the perils of putting Debbie on the stand, Greg's take versus his lawyer's take, and how it ultimately worked out?
I would, as a, in the moment in the trial, I would want to have much more knowledge about Debbie. I would want to interview her closely. I think it's a tough call, but it's one you cannot make as attorney until you get all the facts and you get a feel for the witness and what your defenses are going to be. I think I'd probably agree with Greg on this one, though, in the end, but with the caveat that maybe I changed my mind after I got closer to it.
Rabia?
I think Greg was right on this one. I mean, first of all, you have a number of witness statements, including a statement by Eric Tanner the morning of the murders, putting Greg at home around 12:31 a.m. And this is the same Eric Tanner who will actually testify against him. But he never changes that fact. And you have Greg saying the same thing, and you have his girlfriend Becky saying the same thing. And those are statements they gave the day of the murders. So I think that's part of the thing, is like, how do you counter all of that? Were all of them lying? Are they all in on it then? Like, how do you see what I'm saying? Like, how are they going to deal with this at trial then? But the other thing is, I think for Greg, it was like, what's right is right. That's not what happened. I do believe, I mean, personally, that you got to put on what's closest to the truth that you know, and what's right is right. And I have to agree with Greg on this one, although the other side of that is that then there's literally nobody who testifies for what he was doing between like 8 p.m. to 1 a.m. about.
Right. I mean, I just have so many questions about this, because Debbie seems super sure, and it makes me wonder if she's remembering a different time she spent a night with Greg. Was there a different time that you know of that could have happened? She could be mistaking this encounter for a different encounter?
As far as we know, as far as Greg has told me, and this is the only time it's ever happened. But it was two years earlier.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And they've been drinking. I mean, you know, I don't. Yeah.
Yeah. So my second question here is about, so taking sort of the trickiness of it aside, I mean, part of me is like, the Law and Order episode, the way it would play out is that she'd go on the stand and provide him with this alibi. And then, you know, he'd have the opportunity to say, you know, that's, I don't agree with that alibi, but I still said I didn't do it. And it might be an opportunity for the defense to look like their client's extra honest or something. Maybe that's just how it would play on TV. It probably totally wouldn't work in real life. But my other question was the idea that the jury wouldn't like Debbie.
Yeah.
She's a single pregnant woman. And so she's going to rub them the wrong way or something. That was interesting to me.
It is. I mean, like, there was that, but also I'm guessing Lax is also thinking, this is also a woman who had a one night stand, right? And I'm guessing they're thinking that makes Greg look bad and it makes her look bad as a witness. And this is true. That is reality. Hmm.
But was part of the prosecution's narrative that he was spending the night with another woman? Was that part of their narrative?
Nope, they had no idea.
Oh, so that didn't come up in court at all?
At all.
I see. So any, like, part of this timeline was not part of his trial at all?
Nope.
What was the up to 1 a.m. part of his timeline at trial?
Well, we're going to be talking about trial next week. I keep saying that like every week, but next week is definitely we're talking about the trial. Adding no
Empty
more
promises.
Episodes, no more episodes. Yeah, but I mean, like, it was just a hole. It was just a hole, and that happens all the time. You know, like, I always refer to Adnan's example, but for example, a big hole is like, how did Adnan get in Hayes' car? When? At
right.
what point? Where
right.
there's these holes, and they exist a lot of times.
Hmm. All right. Well, moving on. One of the things that was interesting to me is that Greg is a note keeper and a journal keeper, and he basically narrates and documents like every aspect and every communication he has around this case in his journals. First of all, what did you think about these journals just in general as living documents? Is this something that he was doing before this case happened, or is this something he started doing when he became a suspect in a murder case?
Yeah, no, I mean, I asked him, I said, have you always journaled? Is this like a habit? Was this a habit of yours? And he said no, but he said from the moment he was arrested, he realized, I mean, to him, he felt like, I think it was just kind of like, this is how he operated. He said, you know, if it's not on paper, it's it's not real. He's like, he wanted to document every single thing. And he's very, you know, there's letters to his mom where he says, you know, when you speak to the lawyers, make sure you record the conversations so that everybody knows what actually was said and what was agreed to. He's, I think, just very frantic about like nailing things down and having a record of them because he thinks that could serve as evidence or something, or maybe just, I mean, these journals were not used for anything. They were just for his personal, I think, keeping track of what was happening and who was saying what when. But there's also a lot of interesting stories in there about people he's meeting in prison. Some names that, in fact, be important come up later. Names, in fact, related to suspects that we're going to talk about later. And just other things that are happening. To me, it's one of the most interesting documents, I think, that I've looked at in the case. And it stops, like, in November of 2000, and I almost kind of wish it went on. But in a way, it goes on through the years of letters, but the journal is easier to absorb.
Well, it's a gold mine for someone making a podcast about the case years later. Yeah. But I'm curious about, you know, if someone representing Greg now, like, how valuable would it be that he kept this real-time account of everything that was going on, not for the purpose of, like, you know, lying or faking it later, because you really can't when you're doing it in real time. You don't know how significant a conversation will be unless you go back and erase and edit. And these were handwritten journals, right?
Yeah.
So what do you think, Susan? Goldmine for podcasting and also potentially goldmine legally, or just an interesting thing that this one guy happened to do?
With the caveat that I'd want to make sure they're secure in the way they're doing it, I'd always prefer a client that records everything. I'll take that back. No taking notes on a criminal conspiracy, of course. But for a client after the fact who is documenting things carefully for the attorney, I mean, yeah, I love that.
Yeah.
I will say this, though. He was very meticulous in keeping, like, his business records. I mean, like, you know, like the receipts and checks and cancel, I mean, like, those kinds of things. So I think it kind of fell in line with that same habit. And his mother also just takes a lot of notes.
Yeah, it's interesting. There's like a phenomenon of people who document their life versus people who don't and do it well and are meticulous. Of course, the first person I think about in this case is like Asia, who like kept her high school diaries. And that's always been so fascinating to me. Like, who are you keeping this in posterity for? Like,
Rebecca.
Exactly. But if you know you've been arrested for a murder and, you know, you want to document everything that's going to happen, like, certainly if I were arrested today, like, this would be a great thing to put in practice, knowing what could happen later. Greg obviously couldn't have imagined that. And I'm wondering, like, did he think he was doing this so that later, like, for instance, if he got a new lawyer, he could say, see, look here, on this day I did this and on this day I talked to this person and nothing happened. Is that what he was thinking?
Possibly. But from what I've seen in other cases of the defendants, I think a lot of it is loneliness.
Yeah.
They want to talk to someone. They have so many thoughts and fears and anxieties, and they got a lot of time to have all those thoughts and fears and anxieties going through their head. And this is one way they can explain them to someone, even if it's just a paper, and feel like they're not just uselessly running in circles.
Right. Well, coming back to Debbie, one thing that we talked about last week was how it did not look great for Greg that he married Becky so soon after the murders. It looked, and it was, you know, it was a bad look for several reasons, one of which being that the prosecution can claim that he did it so that she couldn't testify against him, etc. But this week we learn that despite Debbie's unreliability about the timeline of their time together, she also recalls him telling her that he planned to get married very soon during their encounter. So one question I have before you answer that is there any reason to believe that Greg was in touch with Debbie around before or after his arrest and they could have coordinated this story?
I mean, there's nothing to suggest it. And Lax asked her directly and she said she has not, forget the arrest, she hadn't been in contact with Greg since that night.
Like, theoretically, he could have written to her, but they'd have a jail log of that, and they didn't, obviously.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, and I mean, obviously, I think if they had coordinated too, like, maybe her timeline would have been correct, right? I mean, that's... but so, I guess my question is, does this shift either one of your thinking about the perceived weirdness of Greg's marriage? I mean, we know it was fast, but we also know this is how he got married before, but it sounds like, despite everyone saying no one knew, he actually was telling people, or at least he told this person.
Yeah, I mean, you know, in some of Becky's statements, I think she told investigators, or I don't know if it was a defense investigator or the state investigators, but that that they had been talking about marriage for a few months at least. And so, you know, for me, like, here's the way I think about it. If Greg actually had been planning these murders for months and months and thought, okay, you know, Becky could be, you know, I'm going to make sure Becky can't testify against me. I don't think he would have waited till after the murders to marry her. He probably would have married her earlier. Like, that, you know, that would have been easy to do. He could have done that courthouse wedding months earlier if this was part of the plan. So I think it was just, you know, and I think he was, I don't know, he's just smarter than that, I guess, in terms of trying to cover up a crime. I've always thought it was, not always, but, you know, I thought it was shady, but then I realized I just thought it was a bad look. It was just a bad judgment, on his part, but it just seems like, you know, what him and Becky have been saying, that, yeah, they've been thinking about it anyways, was in fact true. I'm more curious about your perception of it, because I know it looked really shady to you.
Yeah, I mean, obviously.
Because Debbie had no way of knowing. Debbie had no way of knowing any of that.
Right, but Greg happened. Could have also just been telling Debbie that he was getting married soon so that she wouldn't expect more of a commitment from him than a one-night stand, right?
That's interesting.
It could have just been like, yeah, this is really fun. Just FYI, I'm getting married soon. Never see you never again. It could have been that. I don't really, like, I think the marriage looks bad, but it only looks bad because of what happened, right? I think it's one of those things. It would have been weird no matter what, but it looks extra bad because of what happened. And, you know, I'm not sure I buy the whole, like, when I saw what happened to the Kaliznikows, I realized that life is short,
right,
kind of thing.
Right.
That seems a little bit like, and I'm not saying he's lying about it. I'm saying that people's memories about why they did things do change over time. And that is a very, very good story, and one that perhaps he folded in and it became a memory because he said it a few times.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, obviously. But I don't know. Something about Debbie is really interesting to me. She has no real stakes here. I don't think she thinks she's getting back together with Greg at this point, right?
Oh, no.
She hasn't talked to him for years.
No. She actually says in her statement to Lex, she's like, I have no romantic interest. It was just a sexual thing. And she's known Greg for, at this point, quite like six. I mean, when they hooked up, she had known him for 4 years already. So they had served in National Guard together for 4 years. She likes Greg. She's attracted to him, but she's not interested in a relationship. But at the same time, she told Lax, she's like, I want to testify. Put me on the stand. She wanted to go to bat for Greg. And Lax is like, nope.
Yeah. Yeah. Because then they would have had to tell her to, like, omit a part of her story. And that's, you know, and
they couldn't tell her to do that. Also, it's interesting. One thing Lax says in his, I don't know how old Lax was at this time. I don't know exactly what was going on here, but Lax flew out to speak to her. He didn't just, like, follow up with a phone call. He went to speak to her. And in that meeting, in the notes, he actually says something about, I didn't include this in the podcast, but he says something about that, you know, one thing he found disturbing about her, that he felt like she put sexual innuendo in everything she was saying.
Hmm.
Now,
that sounds like a very sexist thing to say.
I've seen that. It's like, really, dude? Were you thinking of sex every time you talked to her and you blamed it on her?
Yeah, that's what I'm like, you flew out to meet this
woman.
Well,
he had to. I mean, they did things right with her. Like, even if you don't want to call her, she's an alibi witness. So even if you think it's terrible for your case, you do what they did. And vetting it as hard as you can.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I also just don't like that. I don't like that someone would make a note of that. You know what I mean? Like, there are less sexist ways to record your perceptions.
in the nicest way he could, he made judgments about her morality without actually calling her, you know, the names that he's probably thinking.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I don't think that Greg was preemptively covering his bases. Like, I don't think he was like, all right, so here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to sleep with this woman.
Go kill them.
Tell her I'm getting married so that after I go kill them, when I immediately marry Becky, it will be a surprise to no one. Because I don't think he was thinking that years later she would be contacted as a potential alibi witness in his trial. And if he was thinking that, why wouldn't he just, like, give her a sleeping pill and pretend like he left that room at 6 o'clock in the morning? You know what I mean? There are better ways to cover your bases than mentioning casually potential marriage to someone.
The thing that Lax ends that his memo with after that meeting is because he's really disturbed, because for him, he's like, both these scenarios suck. But he's like, you know, if instead of thinking that maybe she's literally just misremembering, like, you know, they got drunk, they had sex a couple times, she passed out, and she didn't remember what time Greg left, whatever, you know, what he's thinking is that this means that Greg slipped out without Debbie realizing it. So the way he's interpreting it is that Greg is stealthy enough to slip away out of women's beds.
Right.
And in and out of rooms and homes without anybody noting. And so that also could be problematic at trial.
Right. Doesn't look good. Yeah, definitely does not. It could potentially not look good. We did get a question actually from a listener. There's a couple of things about how the question is worded that tells me the listener does not live in the United States, but perhaps from England or the UK, because she spells defense with a C and says solicitor instead of lawyer in her in her question. But I think that another, I'm not going to read her whole question. It's basically about why prosecutors would offer pleas, you know, if they think the person's guilty, wouldn't they want to take them to trial? Or if, does that mean that their case is weak? So Greg did say no to what most attorneys would consider a good plea deal. Does a plea reflect how strong the state thinks their case is all the time, some of the time? In this case, what do you guys think?
Most of the time. I mean, there can be like, you can have cases where, I mean, it's not uncommon to have bluffing where the prosecutor comes in with something like, I'm going to want 1,000 years. And they know their case is weak, but you want to start from a high position and bargain down. Usually, if everything's working right, a weak case that the prosecutor still wants to bring will get a pretty favorable plea offer in the end. Because you can't take every case to trial. There's zero possibility that could work. Like, you can only take a tiny fraction of cases to trial. So most right. have to plea out.
Right. And it is, and Karen just was wondering, like, why would a deal even be offered to someone that they believe planned the murder of two people in cold blood? Like, surely they would never want someone like that to get out. But so can you just do a quick thumbnail sketch of why that would happen for someone who doesn't live in the United States and, like, you know, kind of how, why every case can't go to trial? Just for Karen?
I don't think it'd be that different, actually, under, like, the Commonwealth systems either.
But Susan, if a prosecutor believes that this guy premeditated two murders, offering a plea deal of manslaughter, doesn't that seem odd?
No. I mean, they were going to let Dennis Perry basically walk out of jail that day before he went to, I mean, they, if they have a weak case, to them, it's better to have a murderer get a sentence than have him walk away scot-free.
Yeah. So it is a sign of the strength of their evidence.
When they think there's a good chance they might lose, but they're confident the guy's guilty, they might do that because, like, at least they got something.
Yeah.
Right. Right. So we have a repeat question. I think we've gotten this question every week that we've done this addendum pretty much. Lisa wants to know about other possible suspects. Did Greg find anyone in his own research? Is there mention of suspects in Greg's journals? Rabia, what can you tell us at this time, if anything?
Yes, what I will tell you is episodes 10 and 11 will be all about alternate suspects.
Hmm. So one final question for me. Greg's daughter was born after he was in prison, which is obviously tragic on a number of levels, whether or not he's guilty or not. That's not a great situation. I don't know if you can speak to this, but what has this been like for him as a parent who's never actually had the opportunity to in person spend time with his child outside of the prison setting?
I mean, I think it's been excruciating. I think it's been, you know, it would be hard on anybody. And it certainly also watching his daughter, I mean, she's like 19, 20 years. She's 20 years old, I think now. Lovely young woman. I met her, Susan, as well. And it's been hard on her, too. And there's, and I'll talk about this in one of the episodes about kind of like what happened with Becky and their daughter and how all that unfolded on the outside while Greg was in prison. He also had to fight a custody battle while he was in prison to keep his parental rights. And that was really tough. So yeah, that's probably been one of the hardest things, I'm sure, to see his daughter grow up without him. And I mean, just the letters, I have so many letters and cards that, you know, she's written and they're like, you know, from more recent ones to the ones in like that little child handwriting. And it's pretty heartbreaking to see it.
Susan, do you have thoughts?
I mean, there were a lot of tragedies in her life, and her dad going to prison before she was born was just the first of them.
So, Rabia, you've been promising, and I'm feeling confident that next week we are actually going to get to the trial.
Yes.
what can we look forward to in next week's episode about this case?
You know, so in next week's episode, we're going to see kind of like what was the state's actual case, what convinced a jury to convict. And we are going to be looking at all the results of all the forensic testing that we've mentioned in the past, because there was a slew of forensic testing. I think that's really important. People want to know what were the results of all that testing. The TBI lab was involved, but also the FBI lab was involved in some of the testing. And then look at the kind of the seminal witnesses, I think, that convinced the jury of Greg's guilt, but then take apart some of their statements too, to show, you know, some of the inconsistencies and or contradictions, you know. And that's pretty much it. And then the following episode, I think, is the one. It's kind of like we're like slowly getting up to the crest of the mountain right now with next week's episode, and then it's going to be like an unraveling of everything. And I think that's what listeners are really going to look forward to.
Yeah, that's what I'm looking forward to. I love the unraveling from this team. It's the best thing that you guys do, Susan. I can't wait to hear you unravel.
Yeah, well, I'm excited to get to. Well, not excited. The backstory here for the prosecutor and some of the people in law enforcement.
All right. Well, I can't wait to hear it. So for this week, thank you so much, both you and Rabia, for chatting to me about this case. It continues to be fascinating, and I'm really enjoying both listening and getting the chance to talk to you about it every week. So thanks, guys. Thanks so much for listening to the Undisclosed Addendum and the Greg Lantz series. You can follow the show on social media at Undisclosed Pod, and you can ask questions for future Addendum episodes on Twitter or Facebook. Just use the hashtag UDAddendum. Remember, the sponsors of Undisclosed make it possible for this team to continue doing their great work. So please support all the sponsors you hear about on this show and buy their products. Our executive producer is the great Methil Telhan. Audio production for the Addendum is done by the wonderful Hannah McCarthy. Our theme song is by Patrick Cortez. If you want to hear more of me, check out my true crime and pop culture podcast, Crime Writers On, or listen to These Are Their Stories, the Law and Order and SVU podcast. And of course, this whole thing would not be possible without the incredible organizational skills and work and diligence of the amazing executive producer, Methil Telhan. Special thanks to Kevin Flynn, my partner in crime and life, for picking up some of my work so I could host this series. Thanks to Rabia, Susan, and Colin, who continue making Undisclosed a fulfilling and fun part of my podcasting life. And on behalf of everyone at Undisclosed, thanks so much for listening. We'll be back next week.